Done it an hour later.
Oh, you know what? I think even that wouldn't quite get it. But we'll coordinate that. You know, we'll coordinate that. Erin's starting to like to be the producer, Erin. So she kind of sits over to the side. She doesn't like to be on the camera. She says hi before we start, and then she goes and hides. But she takes care of kind of taking care of looking at like comments and things like that that are coming in. Well, Frank Jacob, this is the real Easter Monday, not Easter Sunday. This is Easter Monday. And well, here we are. So thank you so much for being on Radiant Creators. I saw you on Inspired and then started to watch a lot of the videos you've done on YouTube, checked out some of your content you've got, and thought that gotta talk to Frank on the show because Frank is doing amazing stuff. So I guess, first of all, good afternoon. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Craig. Good to be here.
Our pleasure. It truly is. So I'm going to do, you know, pardon me looking away for a second. I'm just going to read a little. Of course, Frank Jacob can definitely introduce himself, but here's a real quick intro from, it's the first paragraph of his kind of bio. And just so we all kind of know who we're talking to here, filmmaker, composer, researcher, speaker, visionary. After an early start in composing and performing music, Frank evolved into audio, video, post-production, pioneering live cinema along the way, and ultimately morphed into a producer, writer, director, and editor of feature-length documentaries. Deep knowledge of subjects off the beaten path make his award-winning films, speaking engagements, and research into cutting-edge material highly engaging, philosophically relevant, and important in these provocative times. Check out CyberHive TV, the new site featuring Frank's latest releases, webinars, community, and newsletter. And there is a community there. I'm a member. You can start chatting with like-minded people. Two documentaries that I think are definitely relevant that Frank has created are Packing for Mars and Solar Revolution. And recently he's done a webinar. So not a documentary, but a webinar. I believe it's so Frank could just get it done, get it out there. And it's three parts, and it's called A Tale of Two Timelines. And I have to admit, I have not watched it yet, but I'm going to. And that's Frank in a quick nutshell. Is there anything that I missed? What holes would you fill in there?
That's pretty good, you know, actually, out of all the different bios that people read, I like that one. It's nice and short and cuts into the newest stuff and most relevant stuff. So, yeah, essentially, that's me in a nutshell. I went from a media person to a researcher to a filmmaker, etc. And I learned, I guess, early on that, you know, the power of film when I was in high school still, and I just really love the art of filmmaking and how you can convey on such a rich level. Like, you convey visually, you can convey with motion, you can convey with color, you can convey with music or non-music. You know, it's just everything that's expressed in that medium, I thought, was something worth going into. But I always thought of myself as being somebody, I mean, at the time that I was taking those courses, I never realized I would be a filmmaker, because it's a pretty, you know, expensive and unattainable art form for many people. But, you know, as it turns out, with the democratization of technology, it's, and my having been familiar with working on production, post-production with audio, it's pretty much translates one-to-one. You know, you're not looking at a waveform on the screen, you're looking at both a waveform and a visual, which you can play with and arrange properly to make the messages come across. So I always thought of myself as, yeah, I mean, I would love to be a filmmaker, and I eventually became one many, many decades later. But in the meantime, I always thought of myself as a multimedia artist, and that's kind of where I got my first start. And, you know, combining, that's why you mentioned some of those things, or did you, I think, were live cinema. Yeah, you mentioned live cinema. That's an art form that I pioneered, which based around software-driven VJ software that I kind of pushed the envelope on to take it to another level. Yeah.
Yeah. Live cinema. I'm not really familiar with that. And that's,
Well, it's pretty rarely done because it's so difficult. it's like riding a toboggan on the seat of your pants up down a mogul field while you're playing live in front of an audience. Essentially, that's why very few people do it. You've got a computer that's running software, which is so demanding that it could crash at any time. Mm. And it's running visual streams that you're playing like an instrument on a screen. So it's not like you're just putting up. Well, I mean, there are people that as VJs just put kind of repeating loops of cool looking like moving wallpaper. But I always early on saw and applied the art form to actual filmed footage or camera, you know, the camera pointed at people or musicians or something that you can then blend together, take it to another level and eventually tell a story like a film. So that's why I actually coined the term live cinema, not knowing that there really was such an art form. And then around the same time that I brought it out, I think there was only one other mention of that kind of art form that I heard, and that was at Los Angeles. And I was on the other side of the planet in Salzburg, Austria. So, but you know, my level of the production was much more demanding and of course, incorporated many more moving parts. So I always thought of it as kind of like the king's discipline. Like you have to be, you know, on your game live, you know, in front of an audience and doing your art, and you have several different, you know, you've got a whole box of imagery and stuff that you want to convey to tell a story. Plus my own footage that I filmed of people. So I was presenting like actual filmed footage to tell a story using VJ software.
Mm. It reminds me of Joseph Campbell's line that myths need to evolve through time. And so I think myth isn't really the right word. We could just say that, you know, knowledge or info, the deeper things need to evolve through time. Like we have the hero's journey, but then that was upgrade it to the first Star Wars, you know? And it does seem that we're seeing, I think, a lot of spiritual teachings, a lot of, you know, deep esoteric knowledge is getting a kind of evolutionary reboot in that, like, I love Rudolf Steiner, for instance, but that's, he wrote a tremendous amount of text and endless lectures that he did, I mean, that were all transcribed, but I can certainly read it, but I do like that many people are sort of, they do all the work of reading it, then they just kind of boil it down and interpret it. And then, because I think people today like, well, we like video, we like audio.
Yes.
We also like, when it comes to text, just give me some give me a short paragraph and give me some bullet points. You know, we're sort of compressing esoteric knowledge. So it seems like what you're doing is just very kind of natural and evolutionary.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the thing I noticed was that a lot of the more fringe material in the direction of ufology and the paranormal, there was either none of it out there visually, or if it was done in a documentary form, very stale, dry format, like, you know, talking heads, nothing, you know, exciting about it. And then there was just really badly garbled, like, video footage that was made by even early, you know, stuff that was put out by, well, I won't mention any names, but certainly, you know, big names really that were putting out video films, and they were just so bad. And I looked at it and went, you know, really nobody's ever really come along and made a cinematic version of any of this material to make it like palatable for a larger audience and make it more of a higher level of production. And so that was actually the birthplace for my making the film you mentioned, Packing for Mars.
Yes.
Because I went really literally from, you know, doing this kind of really wild visual stuff where you're telling stories on the fly. And I realized this is too nerve-wracking to keep doing. And I got, not really, but I mean, it is very nerve-wracking to do constantly. So at least to the level that I wanted to do it. I mean, I could always just go to a club and play some wallpaper. That's no big deal. But to think out stories and make them interactive with the audience even and things, that was another level. So having done that and done, actually made it all, I was picked up by some people that were part of Doctors Without Borders, and they asked me to do their annual business report for that organization as a visual live performance. And that ended up me being able to go all the way to Carnegie Hall to play that. So I was probably the first VJ ever to play like live cinema at Carnegie Hall. So that was sort of like where I went, okay, I mean, where can you go after this, right? But anyway, I got into, you know, cutting like, you know, sport porn at Red Bull Media House, you know, those quick action-paced, like crazy athletes doing really absolutely insane athletic feats on skis, motorcycles, or, you know, in jumpsuits or base jumping, whatever. So I became, you know, involved in the team that kind of developed that whole editing style from the very start of that organization, which was, you know, set up around 2009, 2010. And, you know, I was able to lucky to be kind of one of the pioneering editors in that direction. So at that point I was like, okay, now it would be good to take this in the direction of, you know, of like ufology or something, do something really cool, make a documentary that really goes into, you know, material that is much more challenging mentally, you know, even involving quantum physics and just more knowledge, higher information than just action sports, which has a limit. I was doing a series with my partner in production, which I later met afterward. Her name is Tanya Maidenford, and she had a company called Screen Addiction. And that was all about, you know, trying to convey higher messages with entertainment. And that's kind of the idea. It's like when you've done, you know, and that was, we got involved. Eventually she was working with me at Red Bull Media House, and we got involved in a series called Ultimate Rush, where you would take adventure stories of these athletes and you would then interview them, and they would give you their footage, which often only they could film, because when you're hanging with one hand on a cliff free, you know, and the other camera is like pinned to your head or to your, you know, shoulder, nobody else could film that kind of stuff. So that's kind of like this series evolved out of material that they had compiled. We would then filter it, create stories, and then go and interview them. And I was always trying to take it in the direction of consciousness. Like, what is it really that's going through their brains when they're doing this stuff? Because it's really life and death. And so that, you know, that kind of brunch. And then eventually I'm like, let's do a whole series. But you could get no takers because the people there were just not visionary in that level. You know, they've got, they're visionary on other levels in terms of, hey, let's figure out how we can do 3D photography or 360 degree cameras and the coolest stuff, you know, technically. But they weren't really mature in terms of, you know, let's add like quantum physics and, you know, fringe science into the pie and make some cool stuff. So that was where I wanted to go. That's why we ended up going our separate ways. And that's how the whole filmmaking genre thing of my career took off, pretty much on the basis of that.
Yeah. In the two documentaries, the Packing for Mars and then Solar Revolution, right?
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So, the third one that you didn't mention, called the Klaus Dana Chronicles, that's not really like a sort of like a cinematic kind of a film like those other two are. But it still is talking and tackling the genre of unexplained mysteries, which is kind of what it evolved out of. Klaus Dana is an out-of-place artifacts researcher, world-renowned, and he was living in Austria. And when I went on the road to begin filming Packing for Mars, and I ran into Alfred Lambermont Weber, he said, hey, there's this guy in Austria. His name is Klaus. You should, you know, and then I reached out to Klaus, and that's how we got together. And, you know, he had no film material, nothing, no books. So I said, hey, you know, let's just make even a basic documentary out of even photos or anything what you have, because your stuff is so crazy. So that's how that documentary came about. So the Klaus Dana Chronicles is probably the only DVD or, you know, streamed film of documentary of Klaus Dana's work, I think, to date. So that's, but it's not really like cinematic like those other two you just mentioned.
Yeah,
I just thought I'd throw that in.
Oh, no, that's great. And the thing is, that really ups the whole game, because I'll agree there's plenty of documentaries out there, and they're becoming more of an art, and there's different, you know, ways of doing it. Of course, a lot of new thought arrives, and so it's an evolutionary process. But definitely, you've kind of upped the game there, because especially when it comes to the, say, ufology or spiritual, you know, or quantum physics, most of those documentaries can be, you know, pretty dry as far as visual and even audio. So the productions you've done, it's a high level of production. And I think that ultimately does lend credence to it. You know, when people are watching this and they go, oh, this isn't, you know, the usual style, which is kind of dry and not very exciting. I mean, most documentaries, you could just listen to, you wouldn't even watch, but you want to get in there and watch it. And so, yeah, I think it's definitely an important evolution. So I'm glad you're doing it, because it's necessary. And then, of course, your three-part webinar, which I have to admit I have not watched yet, only the preview, but that is stunning also. And that's I shouldn't say just a webinar, but that's just a webinar. And even that, from what I've seen of the preview, is, you know, something I'll have to watch, not just listen to.
Well, right. It's not a film per se, like a documentary, but it is because I'm a filmmaker. I like to speak in filmic ways. So I blend a lot of stuff in pictures, photos, film footage, and just conversation so that there it really does kind of rip along. It's not like your typical webinar either. It does have a pace and it just packs a punch, a lot of information. It's in that case, that one you're talking about is a three-parter because I never knew really just how much material there was relative to the Looking Glass. And it was just the idea was, just kind of blurted out like irresponsibly on John Nolan's Inspired channel that, hey, I should just do a webinar about this and go a little deeper. And then I got like hundreds of people writing, so I was kind of cornered. I had to do it. And having produced webinars for the likes of Greg Braden and Dispenza and, Lipton and Dieter Brewers in Germany, other people, like I was used to putting together those things, but on a timeline. So the advantage being that when you're a filmmaker, you can just make them much more interesting, So that was the goal of making a webinar, and also of making it when you're making a film, it can take years really to do it right. So to get this information out, I didn't really want to wait years. I wanted to get the information out now while it was happening, just to keep the energy going. And that's kind of the reason that even came about. And
I
we're
like that.
working on another one, by the way.
Oh, okay. So there's going to be another one. Let's dive into that for a sec. But I do like that. So to me, it seems very evolutionary. And I like that because you had all this data and you wanted to get it out and you go, well, a movie's going to take too long, but I could make a webinar that was actually a mix and interesting. And I can just almost like, I'm not going to do the movie, the long form. I'm just going to, I guess get the baseline going, and I'm just going to improvise. I'm going to create the melody and just get it out there. And that's definitely evolutionary, I think. It's important stuff. So you have another one in the works.
Yeah, that's one I'm working on right now. It's coming out. It's going to be. Am I going to say what it's about? That's a good question. Maybe I should still keep it secret. But it's yeah, it's like it builds on. I can say that it really does build on the first one. The first one being the all about the Looking Glass and the Guardians of the Looking Glass and the J-Rods and all that information. But this one, there's things that I touch on in that webinar that have to do with consciousness, because really that's ultimately my favorite topic, is tying this all into what is it. So what does it do? Like, what's the point of it, right? Is it just to entertain yourself? Well, for me, no. It's like we want to use entertainment to elevate people's thoughts, to put them into to introduce ideas and terminology and concepts that are not normal, that are reaching toward raising of consciousness. And we have a point now, and this has a lot to do with where we've landed in society with transhumanism on the horizon and AI being such a prevalent and dominant aspect, and soon to be, you could say, the major driving force in society. If we do nothing to stop it, it'll literally, there's people out there now in the field, reporters, not just reporters, but researchers that are saying it's going to kill mankind. It's like they're just, putting, and we've heard all of those Elon Musk quotes. It's the most dangerous thing out there. In fact, Elon and a few others signed a petition recently that demands the halt of like, what do they call it?
Is it Chat
Strong
GPT?
artificial intelligence. That we've reached a plateau with artificial intelligence that is enough to put us into a golden age. We could already have a golden age right now. If we put the brakes on and stop any further development of artificial intelligence, we're still going to revolutionize society if we implement it in all the creative ways that we can. So all of this stuff is talked about a little bit in the Tale of Two Timelines, especially the idea that, what are we going to do? How can we compete with what's coming? And we've got all this movement out there for, like, headed by the WEF and Klaus Schwabsters, the Yuval Harari crowd that is burning and chomping at the bit to become transhumanist, like Kurzweil's idea of transplanting the human brain into like some kind of an immortal carrier and then become gods, right? Even though we already are creator gods in the small g sense, that there's a creator. None of these people driving this stuff are necessarily believers. They're all either agnostics or atheists. And so they think they can improve on the human genome. And so what is it that we can do to combat that movement, especially in relative to timelines? Because that is kind of the base foundation of the Looking Glass webinar, is like, which timeline? That's why it's called A Tale of Two Timelines. Which timeline are we going to land on? The artificial intelligence timeline or the natural human biological timeline that has reached its fullness, culmination of human evolution, in that sense of the next evolutionary leap in mankind? Humankind is going to have to be done in the next 20 years, and it'll either be one direction or the other direction. And so what this new webinar is about is building on what I showed a little bit in The Tale of Two Timelines with respect to cosmic energies coming at us from the center of the galaxy and how it affects our bodies, physiological. So I go much more into that and talk about that. In fact, it encompasses, goes all the way to the very beginnings of civilization in the ancient days, right up to now. So it's going to be, I wanted it to be a short one, but it's already looking to be a little bit longer than I wanted it to be. And I've got some great people in it too. Like I'm doing like interviews of some of the foremost, you know, authors or thinkers on these topics. And so I'm building on their stuff. It's going to be kind of a hybrid, you could say, film, interview, podcast, webinar thing. I think people are going to like it.
Oh, I definitely think so. And the topic, when it comes to the, of course, we do know that there's new energies coming to the Earth. One can look at just the sun cycles, but also from the center of the universe. And one can definitely deep dive on where those are coming from. But I think something that is really getting people together that I notice, and I love that you call, you coined the term light activist. And I think that's on. I like that. And so light activists are turning on. And one of the things that's getting people together in little tribes, and then that cymatic pattern of these tribes are all connecting, is that we're feeling it. I think that anybody a hint of natural human organic intuition is feeling the future pull of those two timelines. And yeah. So have you noticed that? I think that the bifurcation of humanity, that splitting of timelines, I'll coin for a sec Rudolf Steiner's term, the aromonic, the machine human, the eighth sphere, as he put it. And he did believe that at this time we would have a physical incarnation of Ahriman, literally like a physical incarnation of the energy. And that to me is transhumanism. It's pretty clear. And then of course we have the natural organic human, you know, who's really getting back to almost like their roots of aliveness. They're sort of a neo-aboriginal, you know? So you have this really primal, beautiful, futuristic organic humans. Then you have the transhumanist humans. And does it seem like it's turning people on? People are feeling it. It really seems like this is a big moment for humanity.
It is. I think it's the most significant moment that humanity has experienced since it came about. Whether it was created, whether, you know, it evolved, whatever, whichever one, you know, whichever camp you're in, it doesn't matter. We've reached a point now where we have the technological means to realize what we used to only be able to talk about in science fiction films. I think people feel it because they feel the possibilities of both. Those people who are entranced with materialistic ideals and the idea of manifesting whatever you want, you know, like material things, like, oh, I can have this and I can have that. And it's all about, you know, having things, right? Easily and quickly without any effort. You know, all these are very enticing elements. Like you were saying, even the idea of media consumption has reduced to like tweets or Instagrams or TikToks, where there's like a minute, you know, to explain, or 200 characters, because it's got to be this instant gratification. And yet at the same time, there's this other enticing aspect of things that have started in the 70s with meditation and developed into yoga and became the new age. And then itself became kind of polluted with a lot of misdirected energy and, you know, really consumption oriented commercialism rather than pure integrity. But there's the idea is that has also grown in the last 30, 40, 50 years to the point where we can see where, you know, where our consciousness is going. But of course, there's less people, I think, that are interested in the idea of human consciousness on a biological level than there are people involved in the materialist level, because, you know, the spirituality has been in a war against materialism really since the days of Copernicus, you know, where science said, no, there's no God. It's like we're just accidental particles that have smashed together over eternity and enough times that eventually consciousness emerged, right? That's their conspiracy theory, which is a pretty good one, you know, but they, you know, their theories are pretty weak too, because if you look at, you know, the Big Bang, and if you look at relativity and all these theories, they really break down quickly when you start asking some of the questions that just don't make sense. Some of the things, like you point out some of the things that just, they couldn't be, and, you know, and, but they are, you know, so how do they explain that? Well, they just explain it by adding a bunch of zeros on the end, you know? Well, it didn't happen in the first go. It happened in the 10 to the 120th go, you know? And then and if it didn't happen in the 10 to 120th go, it happened in one of the infinite number of multiverses which happened, where there it could have happened to the one, to the 10 to the 120th, right? So it just keeps going ad absurdum. And, you know, it's just, and then you get a whole school of people developing that theory, that theoretical worldview, and that is funded and paid, and the universities are supporting it, and because it's atheistic, it's not saying, hey, there's a creator, the creation created this thing, it's boom, there it was, you know, and the Big Bang isn't true, the Big Bang is a ridiculous theory, it's all about consciousness and electricity, and, you know, it emerges from the ether. That's why you can explain this and this and that. And the fractal, you know, this kind of stuff is the fringe. That's the minority of people, even though it makes a lot more sense in a lot of ways. But still, it's like that analogy between, you know, the room is totally dark, but you just take one match and you light the whole huge room up with a single match. So there is kind of the ratio between consciousness and materialism can be equally extreme, I think, that when people make a breakthrough on a consciousness level, on the biological level, the anatomical level of humanity, then I think that's going to quickly, exponentially convince those people who are knowing it inside. We all sense it, that there is this higher level of us, but we're afraid to express it. We've been taught to suppress it. And some people are going to break through, and they're going to pull all the others with it. It'll be exponential. And that's still going to happen in the next 20 years, I would say. Maybe.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's definitely happening. Yeah. I mean, it's right on top of us ultimately, I think. And there's so many traps. Like, one that I see people starting to step out of is, churchgoers, which is totally fine. But one of the issues is that it's so ingrained, is that God's outside of you, you know? And so I'm seeing a lot of churchgoers who have been, you know, really indoctrinated with that. I mean, they're actually really afraid to say that, you know, the whole biblical line of I and the Father are one, but the Father is greater than I, as in you're the conceived and the conceiver. You created yourself, and now you see through that creation, but you're equal. I mean, that is blasphemy, but according to, like, traditional churchgoers. But they're starting to shake that off, and I'm seeing it at a rather pleasurable rate. People are starting to go, wait a second. God's not outside of me any longer. I am. And that's a huge consciousness, I think, hitting the earth plane right now too. It's just, I am. And people are really starting to contemplate that. And that's where you see this bifurcation of humanity. Another thing is, like, I think about analog versus digital when you were talking, how, you know, we do have a lot of people are strictly digital, and many people have grown up in an entirely digital world. And I think we're both old enough to have experience with records. And I started thinking what so many people that are a bit younger than I am have missed, who've never actually played a record and had that analog experience of life. They may have never even seen a clock that you actually wind up.
Right. Even I remember watching a video recently somebody sent me of young kids, like teenagers, trying to figure out a dial phone. Like, they couldn't figure out how to use a dial phone. It was great. Yeah. It's a cool video. It's really funny. They're trying to figure it out. Like, how do you work this thing, right?
And so
But it's a total different experience. Again, even analog. I remember when analog, when digital began to emerge, and I was and heavily in music production at that point. And of course, you know, when you think about the cost of tape and all the noise reduction technologies that have been developed, you know, Dolby B, Dolby C, Dolby S, whatever, you know, all to bring down the noise, the white noise, that stuff that you hear on the tape whenever you're recording. And then along comes digital, and you think, oh, wow, this is going to be so clean. No more tape hiss. But what you don't realize at the time, because you're just, you know, not aware of it, and nobody can be blamed for this because we're just trying to make music in the cheapest way that we can to get our demos out there and become famous and keep going, you know. But what you don't realize is that digital works as a sample, and the sample means that you can only, you know, depending on the speed of the computer, sample so many times per second. And any more, and anything in between those samples is missing. Whereas analog, you put a tape on or a record needle pulling across the groove, there's not one instance of time where it's not connected to the sound. That sound wave is beautifully perfect. You know, that the sine waves are just, they're traveling through the air, they're going from the needle to an amplifier to the air to your ear to your brain unimpeded. Perfect sound, absolute 100 perfect, pure, pristine sound. Okay, there's white noise in there, but the brain has an amazing way to tune that out as well. And it, but also, there's been studies done with white noise and pink noise, and that they actually are calming for the human spirit as well. Some people put them on, you know, they put on a bit of a low grade background pink noise, and it actually reduces stress. But what I'm saying is that with the digital, with those slices, you only slice, like in the beginning, it was very bad. You know, I think 100 and well, you had, you know, CDs, which were 44.1 hertz, right? I mean, which basically sampled at 16 bits, you know, which that meant like 16,000 times per second, I believe. And so in between those 16,000, and you think that sounds like a lot, right? But I mean, compared to infinite, it's not much. And of course, you know, they got better, the computers got faster, and now we have MP3s. First they were like, you know, 92 kilobits per second. That's 92,000 times per second, then 128,000 times, which is 128K, and 320K is like what most people have now, which is the point where they think that your ear can't tell the difference. But still, there are gaps between the samples, right? So you're still not getting, so you're tricking the human ear to believing that it's reality, but it's a virtual reality. So the all digital sound is not real, it's virtual. It's virtual. And that's the first introduction of the virtual reality into our world. That's the first place it took that the first place it took place. But people,
Oh,
kids
it's
that are out
yeah.
there that might be listening to this, they don't even realize that. I would highly recommend any teenager now or young kid or child or young adult go and buy a good turntable. They're probably not even that expensive. And get, you know, get some vinyl. That might be a little bit more difficult, but I think vinyl is making a comeback.
Big time.
You can find a lot of stuff, and you know, that's on vinyl, and just sit down and listen to the vinyl experience on a good, you know, good speakers, you know, and just take it in, and then put on digital, and you'll realize, whoa, like just note how you feel. It affects your soul on a different level when you're listening to analog. And so this is a really good analogy you brought up, because this is exactly what Yuval Harari and Klaus Schwab and all these people, when they talk about transhumanism and taking the human mind and the human genome and digitizing it and creating a digital version of humanity to become immortal gods, they're going to become immortal virtual gods. They're not going to be real human beings. Only we have the exclusivity on human beingness right now, still for their last maybe generation. I always tell people, if we don't stop them, it really is the final generation. We're the last vinyl records right now, people. We're it. We're that's you know, we're it. We're the last vinyl. And
Oh, that's amazing.
once we're gone, there's no more vinyl. If no one makes vinyl again, and the records stop, and there's no more turntables, which took, you know, happened for a while, then it's over. It'll never come back. It'll always be an emulation. And if they do come back in the future, they'll only be taking a virtual thing and putting it onto an analog thing, but it'll still be recorded with those gaps in between. So it'll still not be the real thing.
Oh, yeah. And old phone lines, old copper phone lines. I think we were talking at, I think it was just 8 kilobits or something like that. It was but I think most of us who actually used an analog phone line, a copper phone line, we kind of miss that warmth, that tone, the heavy receiver, you know, and talking back and forth. But there's no cell phone that can match that tone. And the thing about records also, thrift stores, if a person likes to go to Goodwill or any thrift stores, you know, they are full of records, you know. So, and the nice thing about the old records is that there's so many things that are on records that are gone now. It's on that record. And there may be like three of that record that exists, or maybe just one. And so as those records get like deleted from our experience, there's music that there's no master copy anymore. It's long since gone. It just disappears. And so you really can kind of archive history. And that's the thing about something you'd mentioned. It's good to collect old books with pictures and old magazines and such. And also, ultimately, old analog recordings because, like, they don't change. So, yeah, thrift stores, they have lots of record players, you know, and they have tons of records. And you can just, you know, it's one thing we don't do anymore is actually go through and look at album covers. What this? Oh, that looks interesting. Oh, look at this. It's right. A person standing on a donkey playing a ukulele.
Right.
You know, I got to hear this. And so, yeah, what an exploration. Well, so people are, well, one thing about the white noise is, something I wanted to mention is the Schumann resonance is something that you've touched on for sure. And it's almost like that white noise in the analog recording. That's kind of like the Schumann resonance. It makes us feel, it's the Schumann resonance of the recording. It's something very human, something very analog. And leading up to this, I think the last 2 days or so, the Schumann resonance has really been off the charts. And how do you feel that is affecting people? Because, you know, a lot of people I know, when the Schumann resonance gets bumped up, they instantly have a ringing in their ears. They can feel it in their body, and they'll say, and they go and they check and they go, yep, it's up. So we're very tied to our Schumann resonance. I mean, Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, he wrote that when we travel to different planets in our little hotel room, we have to have our resonance of our planet or else we start getting ill. And then also the International Space Station, I know it had it. I'm not sure if the Apollo missions had it, but they had to actually create a Schumann resonance generator because the astronauts would get sick without it. And right now, our Schumann resonance, if one watches and we can see it online live, it's really it looks like an old analog recording.
Yes, because you know, what's the Schumann? I mean, it used to be kind of really rare to talk about these kinds of things, and I'm finding it interesting since I met with, for example, and the man we made the film Solar Revolution with, a German biophysicist, Dieter Burs. He's been observing the Schumann resonances and the solar activity for like the last 30 years. And he was telling me that, you know, a couple of years ago, even, you know, just talking about the Schumann resonances and showing these graphs and things, it was like, you know, super rare. People didn't really know much about it. It was, you know, kind of, fringe type stuff. But now it's like, it's become, you've got all these people that sprung up on YouTube with their own channels that are showing and analyzing the Schumann frequencies and the space weather and all this stuff. But essentially, it does come down to the Schumann frequencies being kind of the critical thing that ties, that makes us human, that make our brains function the way they function. And that's why the idea of, like, for example, just the idea of many different aliens. Okay. I know there's a lot of people that are into UFOs and all these different species out there, and apparently they're already all here. Well, the thing is, they couldn't be here unless their planet had the exact same Schumann frequencies as ours. They can't. They either have to put, you know, some protective, you know, suits on then to give them that resonance, or they have, maybe they're not even in. You know, this is one of the things that I'm kind of debating, because I hear, you know, we're even working on a film about ETs, and, you know, there's all these species, you know, that people talk about. Well, they could never be here on the planet because they would, unless they were humans that came from here, which is why the J-Rods is the only extraterrestrial imagery that I've, you know, and we see that in the Tale of Two Timelines webinar. Those recordings, I believe, are authentic simply because those aren't technically really ETs, but actually human beings from the future. So they have in their genetic memory the resonance of the understanding of the functionality of resonance of the Schumann frequencies on our planet. Now, these aliens that are out there, they either have to be in suits or protective, you know, kind of environments, or they couldn't be in the physical. Maybe they're not even in the physical dimension. Maybe they're in the astral, which is why, yeah, I think I'm leaning toward more of the astral explanation. You know, people are saying, oh, they're having contact with them, they're talking to them, they're channeling them. Of course, there's never any evidence. There's never any photos. There's nothing. They don't show up and say, come on down, let me introduce you to my family. And then the family meets them, you know, and they go, oh, my God, they really are real. No, you never hear that. You only hear the stories, and you have to believe those stories. But I think the only way to really not write them all off as lunatics or just complete frauds is that they must be communicating on an astral level. And that's definitely feasible because, you know, we basically don't always, we exist on multidimensional beings, so we can exist on higher other dimensions. And the Schumann frequencies are basically what resonate with our brains in the state of the alpha, moving into the next states of consciousness. So just beyond, like just at the point of the cusp of consciousness. So it's that crossing the veil between like the 7.83 hertz. 8 hertz is that frequency that is right at the cusp of between subconscious. You're in a dream state, you don't remember any of it. When you wake up the next day, you know you had a couple of dreams, but you don't know what they are. And consciousness, waking states of consciousness, where you are just taking in stimuli from the external world. And so that frequency is very, very special and very magical. And that's probably why 8 hertz is the way it is. In fact, it's an interdimensional frequency. We were talking about the experiments they did with astronauts that they realized, you know, they needed the Schumann frequencies when they went outside of the, you know, of the Earth's bubble. And one of the main researchers in that was a guy called Trofimov. He's a Russian. And he figured out that once the astronauts, when they went outside of the magnetosphere of the Earth, they developed a higher consciousness just out of by default, that they kind of saw the bigger picture. They were no longer bound by that magnetosphere, and that them kind of go rogue a little bit. They're like, well, what am I doing this for? This is stupid. And do some stupid experiments, you know, they had to figure out a way to train them to be in that state of consciousness and still feel the need and you know, to fulfill their duties. And they would put them into isolated magnetospheres. They would put them into environments for days, weeks, months even. And they did this with tens of thousands of people where they were shut off from the Earth's magnetosphere. And what happened is they developed telepathic abilities. Their aging slowed down or stopped completely or reversed, okay? And it's funny because you hear about the Looking Glass Guardians. They talk about how when this cosmic event happens, we'll go back to being the age of 20. In fact, I made a little video about it. I don't know if we should show it, but that one I called the singularity. And that talks about how we will be, you know, we'll regenerate to a youthful appearance. Well, there's science behind that. And Trofimov proved it with those isolation chambers. And it was interesting because all those people began to have telekinetic abilities and it was universal. So this is something that we can kind of expect is going to happen, and our Earth's magnetosphere is just diminishing right now.
And yes,
this is making a lot of people more prone to psychic ability. So it's the optimal time right now in the evolution of our planet. And this is one of those things that I was talking about in Tales of Timelines. What do we have working going for us, right, against all these evil transhumanists out there? What technology do we have that we can counter that with? Well, we have that kind of technology, and that technology ties us into these states of consciousness that surpass what physics laws try to bind us within, which is going to be what artificial intelligence is always going to be limited to.
Yes.
It'll always be within a material carrier. It might use the same electrons, but it's still going to be bound to the dimensional, materialist dimensional realm, and not able to go beyond that. At least, you know, what some people surmise, like the 12th, what Burkhard Heim described in his mathematical formulas as the 12th dimension. That's the dimension of kind of like the source dimension. And the AI is not able to reach that. So there's a lot of interesting discussions about that. Not enough, I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think we really should be talking about this much more, because it's coming very, very quickly, like a 100-mile-an-hour freight train, and it's just around the corner. And when it hits, it's like Jordy Rose described, like a tsunami, and people are going to be, you know, totally, what do we do? You know, it's going to be too late to deal with it when it's here, because it'll be reacting only and not preparing. We should be preparing now for it, and we should be stopping it. And Bill Gates doesn't want to stop it.
Oh, no. So,
yeah, I mean, that letter I was telling you about, that petition, you know, the only one, the guy who's developing AI largely that doesn't sign it is, well, him. You know, of course, it's him. Because he's the same guy that's trying to stop the sun from coming into our atmosphere. And, I mean, the guy is just, you know, he's trying to make sure we only eat synthetic meat from now on. I mean, everything artificial, anti-human is somehow embodied within the guy with those seven letters or eight letters in his name.
Oh, it certainly is. Yeah, it's like you get your lab grown meat, but if you have a really high social credit score, you get a cricket. Yeah, you do. Well, right. No, if you can show the video, that's totally fine. And if you're set up and you can display it, sure, we'll go for it.
Sure, if I can, I can do that. Here, hold on a second. Let me see if I can pull it up.
Yeah. Well. One thing about the Schumann resonance that really, with our ionosphere weakening, which is natural at this time, this cycle happening, I had not really thought of that, the way that affects consciousness that way. And one of the things that we see so much is people saying that as the Schumann resonance gets spiked, as it gets higher, that is sort of a transcendence. But no, not really. I see what you're saying. That makes way more sense. And also, an energy healer who is quite accomplished. I've seen her do amazing things. I mean, she uses tuning forks. And she was saying that, you know, if your Schumann resonance actually rose, everyone always talks about raising your vibe. She's like, you would die.
Yeah, you would go crazy first and then you would die. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's just because people don't understand it. And at the very beginning, I noticed that's because when all this information started flooding on YouTube, on Facebook and whatnot, they would show these extremely high amplified signals, which would go off the charts, and it looks like the frequencies went high. But what it is it's the amplitude it's like juicing the signal. So the 8 hertz, you know, the 12, 14, 39, all these different subharmonics, they're all still there. They're just extremely amplified, like somebody cranked the volume so high that, you know, the speakers blew up. And when you see those blank, you know, drop-offs on those charts that people show online, we've showed some of them. I do this show with Dieter often. We analyze the, like recently, a couple of weeks ago, we had some very, very intense solar activity and cosmic activity, and it was hitting the planet at like speeds of 3.19 million kilometers per second, and it was blowing out all the measuring stations. The magnetospheres were dropping off, the Schumann measurement stations were dropping off, Katomsk, all these ones that are out there. And it's only showing us that they're not calibrated to deal with those kinds of energy levels. It's the same thing, going back to the analogy of analog of music, is if you have an amp, and the amp is much more powerful than the speakers are able to handle, when you reach that threshold of turning the volume up so loud, the speakers will blow and you'll hear nothing. So the equivalent of speakers blowing and hearing nothing is when you see those Schumann resonance meters that just go blank for like a couple of days because they just blew up. It does not mean the frequencies shot up and we're now up in higher frequencies. No, that's the Earth would have to change size for that to be true. Okay, so here, I'll play you this video. Yes. Hold on, let me put this up.
Let's see if I can make it a little bigger. Let's see.
We are the guardians of the looking glass. We are a group of former intelligence officers and military officials who have come together to release classified information about future events to come. Our knowledge comes from our work on the Looking Glass artifact, first discovered in Iraq in the 1990s. We were able to see dozens of future timelines and the convergence or singularities that led to two possible outcomes by the year 2030. In one outcome, humanity awakens and the current order is dismantled. An event then occurs, and instead of this event being negative, it is a positive one. Billions of people go outside during the cosmic event and receive cosmic particles that upgrade their DNA and extra-dimensional vibratory signature. Within weeks, they gain a youthful appearance, psychic abilities, and enchanted physical and cognitive function. The power structure. They also receive this cosmic upgrade. But due to their existing negative energies, it is not absorbed as well. The cosmic event only gives them small benefits, and they are left mostly homeless, to beg on the streets. Humanity does not take revenge on them, but instead, humanity takes pity on them. And there are groups that offer them some food and shelter.
There can't be any large-scale revolution until there's a personal evolution within.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was going to ask you. So, what is the Looking Glass? It was an artifact that was found.
Right. What we've been told from the whistleblowers, in this case Dan Burrish, was describing it in his interviews, is that once we made contact with these future humans in the form of a J-Rod that Dan Burrish spent a long time working together with, he began a telepathic communication with this being, and this being told him essentially, you know, about the Looking Glass, and that it emerged, like that it basically comes from Sumerian sealed cylinders, or cylinder seals, sorry, Sumerian cylinder seals, which have depicted kind of the building plans for this device, which was a device which was used for scrying, you know, back then, because it was, as far as I understand, they basically built it on certain reflecting certain biological parts in our own bodies, and they took that technology and they began in the 50s to reverse or to modify it and to build on it to the point where they got it to in the 90s, where you see those images of the Area 51 shot of the Looking Glass in that chamber with the two cameras that I show in the webinar that a lot of people know about and I've seen. I mean, and so basically this helped them to to project, you know, to scry, or to, in other words, to tune into future events or past events even. But they did this because it was not only a technical device, but it was a device that had to be placed in the area of these portals, these what they call stargates, these energy vortexes, which are prevalent around the planet. And there's other areas that have them, and a lot of them are found in the Middle East. So when they talk about how, you know, their work together with a Looking Glass artifact in Iraq, they're talking about that technology being located in that area because of the stargates that were located there. And some people, of course, also there's theories that they started the whole Iraq war.
Yes.
Simply because they wanted to move in to that area and take charge of that technology. I don't know if I subscribe to that, but I mean, that's one of the things that's out there. I don't think they would have had to do that because, you know, nothing's ever stopped them from kind of putting in their little CIA units, mm-hmm. moving into an area, grabbing a technology or grabbing a UFO wreckage or whatever it is that they find, and then taking it and reverse engineering it in secret. So I think that it sounds like an interesting tale, like a lot of stuff, just like the secret space program leans a lot on the fictions invented about the Germans after the Second World War. So I don't know how much, you know, credence to give to that. I don't think it's important. I think the fact is that that kind of technology is real, because there's been enough whistleblowers or eyewitnesses that have kind of blurted out that they've either seen it, they've seen briefing documents that reference it, or there is relative technology such as the Chronovisor, which we talk about in Packing for Mars, which is a device also used for tuning into remnant leftover resonances that are stored in the magnetosphere of the planet. So, you know, I think it's absolutely legit. It's just a matter of, you know, the question is, how many are there? Who's using it? Is it still in use? And, you know, are people aware of the dangers of working with it? And have they mitigated those dangers? Now, in the testimonies that were brought up by Burish and Bill Wood, which then, of course, Bill Wood being Brock Brader, was later, you know, thrown off of his, dethroned, you might say, because he was involved in a court case having sexual relations with a minor. That kind of discredited him, even though he maintains his story and says that it's true and what Kerry Cassidy recorded is real. It threw a lot of doubt on his credibility. But nonetheless, you know, he was talking about essentially the same kinds of stuff. But I even asked the Looking Glass Guardians when they were still active, and I asked them about Bill Wood, and they said they knew of him, and he was one of these people that was out there presenting 50% truth and 50% lies. This sort of this famous thing that we see going on in the secret space program. They put people in shills, actors, paid provocateurs that essentially bring out some truth to attract those people that are in the intellectual pursuit and that have a sincere need to know what's really going on and can sense stuff that's going on and want to know the truth. And then they wash it down with, you know, all this other fairy tale stuff they add into it. And we know also from the communication between Burish and, you know, because he was one of the outsourced participants in what was known as Majestic 12 or the Majestic program, Majestic being a group of people that was put together, you know, very early in 1947 to take charge of all of this paranormal activity, UFOs and crashes and whatnot, and, you know, put a seal of secrecy on it and bring in experts to work on this technology, to reverse engineer the technology and try to gain some advantage for the United States technologically and, of course, militarily. And that's how Dan Burish came into contact with that material. And what that material shows us, and which I show in the Tale of Two Timelines also, is that the group itself had very specific tasks, all of those members. And one of the members, General Twining is his name, had the job of putting disinformation out there into the UFO scene. So you can imagine that, you know, since 1947, some of the truth that's been put out there, fed as, you know, as disinfo by the looking by the Majestic people, has now grown into huge cultural, you know, branches of the UFO scene and may be completely fictitious. But the fact is, the human creativity and the human imagination is so profound that, you know, we can invent stories and have other people, you know, even channel and tune into that invention, because we have this two-way communication going on between what's going on in our brain, which you talk about with the Schumann frequencies, and we feed the field with our own creativity. And that field is then containing those, what could be imaginary, you know, inventions. And those are then, again, tuned in by people that are able to tune into the Schumann frequency psychically or other such levels of consciousness. And they pull that in thinking it's true. And then it's like a reinforcing loop of falsity. So we have to realize in our world right now, we have a lot, we have to be open to this. It's not easy to pill to swallow, but that so much of the information in the disclosure or in the UFO field is of that nature, that it was completely fabricated or largely fabricated. And it has become, through series of repeated loops, reinforced. And so it's become a field, an energy field and an information field all on its own, stored in the magnetosphere, but it doesn't make it true. Right. So, you know, that's why I always call myself kind of a consciousness archaeologist more than anything now, because it's really a matter of archaeology. You you got to go through the layers of deception to try and get to what really might be true. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. We are creative, literally reality creating consciousness. And so if a person wants to, they can go back in time consciously and then imagine something. They can put it in that, and basically now it exists in the, it becomes ultimately a timeline, you could say. It exists now. You can call it a time sphere, however a person wants to look at it. But the individual or group of individuals who imagines, okay, in 1947, this happened, and they spend time there, they can create a, the thing is, others will pick up on that. I mean, our consciousness, it does know the difference, but it can be very difficult to know the difference between an imagined history that somebody else put there, and then, of course, what is really there. And that's where I think one of the incredibly important aspects of our time is we all need to, and it's inherent within us, we can do it, we need to supercharge and fine-tune our intuition. I feel like that is one of our essential survival skills at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right on, you know, with that. I think the intuition is also tied to our heart. And, you know, we've been living very mind-centric and not heart-centric. And a lot of the, you know, people now that are out there are talking about, we have to become more in our hearts and we have to think more from our heart perspective. And it is true that our heart actually has its own brain, and our heart's brain informs our own brain. Yeah. So the two of them are in a dialogue with each other. And I thought one of the more interesting things or profound things that I've heard recently is, because we, you know, being somebody exploring this idea of the magnetosphere that's weakening, and of course, along with that is the pole shift, another yes. topic. But the magnetosphere that's weakening means that we are getting hit with more of those cosmic particles that normally the magnetosphere is there to shield us from. Right. So the question is, you know, what happens if the magnetosphere drops completely? Are we going to be completely exposed to this toxicity coming from the universe? And that's why that video, I did that video because I want to reinforce that timeline, because that timeline described by the Looking Glass Guardians is the positive timeline. Because we've heard a lot about the negative timeline, and we see much more evidence of the negative timeline around us than we see the positive timeline. So I felt it was important to put together a short little blurb to reinforce the idea of there's a positive timeline. It's going to be based on these particles that they talk about that are going to hit us, and they're going to convert us, and they're going to change us. They're going to change us on a physical level, and this actually is possible. And the people that you see, the elite, you know, which I used, I borrowed, you know, really, I just, you know, the idea of somebody put something about Trump being arrested on the Washington Post, and it was went viral. I borrowed that idea to impart that message in this video, where you see Kissinger and Soros and you know, Merkel and Yuval Harari and Klaus Schwab as beggars on the streets, right? Mm. And because it's a matter, it's sort of like there's a word for that. I always forget the word of his P something. That doesn't matter. But there's this idea of when you wish for, when you visualize something, you anchor it here first. That's the first step. Yes. It's like astral projection, you know, it's in the astral, but you have to bring it to the physical. It has to connect between the astral and the physical. And so the first step to manifesting, and we're manifestors, we're actually creative beings, is to visualize it, and then we can draw it into reality. We can actually rein it into consciousness, into this matrix that we're in. That's where we can create. That's what we can do that no machine will ever be able to do. So that was the whole purpose of that. But it shows in this video, talks about how we're changed, right? And so the only way that could be true is if we're being, you know, increasingly exposed to these frequencies coming at us from the cosmos. And this is exactly what's going on right now. So this is on a time scale, timetable level, what the Looking Glass Guardians revealed is so on the money. It's just, it's shocking, right? I mean, there's so much truth in their messages, whoever they are, wherever they went, if it was, you know, a psyop, some people thought it was a psyop, it doesn't matter. Their information was very, very truthful. What they're describing is really indeed happening. And it really would happen so that we would actually, you know, raise our consciousness through this stimulation, except that there's something blocking that or trying to block that from happening. And that has to do with this mRNA technology, right? We've been talking about that. I've done some interviews with some leading experts
oh, yes.
in that field that is just shocking when you get into that. So I felt important to do a video that was positive and reminded people of this reality, because it could happen that we are going to be affected by these. We talked at the very beginning of the show about how people feel it. You know, they feel these changes coming. And what do we do with that, right? We have to prepare ourselves for it already now. It's not just going to flip a switch and we just become conscious. We're going to be disoriented if we haven't prepared to some extent for this. We're going to be shocked. It'll be an unusual, uncomfortable feeling. And to avoid that feeling and to make the most use of that moment when it does happen is to prepare ourselves for it and to begin to visualize. And the visualization is the part of anchoring the timeline that we want into our reality as a frequency anchor. That's what's represented there. And that's what I think we really, really need to do. And the point that sent me off on this branch was that if the magnetosphere is getting weaker and weaker, how are we going to cope with this energy field, with this energy coming at us from the center? Well, it's really interesting because the heart plays the critical role here. Our heart actually projects a magnetosphere around our bodies up to 4 meters. Depending on how powerful our heart is, right? But we actually have our own protective envelope in the form of our heart that projects a magnetic force field around our bodies. So maybe in this new dimension, in this new world that we step into, when we raise our consciousness, we will be unaffected by these rays that are coming at us, because we will no longer be resonating on the frequency where we are affected. We're going to be resonating on a higher, finer frequency, which is the point of preparing ourselves for it, because higher consciousness is higher frequency. Very easy. Just like, again, the analogy of music. If you have a sample at 92 or 96 kilohertz, listening to 320 kilohertz by comparison, it's much more information, higher vibration, higher signal, much richer, much better information. This is the same thing as our consciousness. When we start to deal with higher consciousness thoughts and preparing ourselves for a higher consciousness state of being, then we won't be shocked. And when this happens, our heart can maybe even step up to the plate and become that new magnetosphere around our bodies. We will no longer need the magnetosphere around our earth. Maybe it'll change the relationship between us and the magnetosphere will change. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was the idea that the chronovisor, for example, tunes into the magnetosphere. And Persinger, Michael Persinger, who we interviewed in Solar Revolution, which I really recommend people should see, because he explains it so well, what the magnetosphere is. It's like a repository of all of our thoughts, like we were describing with the idea of putting out even fake information and channeling that. That comes from the magnet. It's like stored on this giant hard drive or like a giant tape. Tape is probably even a better way of looking at it, even though hard drives are magnetic too. But, you know, an easy analogy is you have a tape, right? We all remember, or even that's a technology, which are probably a lot of people these days and never even touch it anymore. But think of a cassette, right? A cassette, what is it? It's a piece of metal running across a tape head that picks up the changes in the piece of metal, the magnetic changes, right? Well, so if you have a tape that's programmed or recorded of your artist or whatever you've got on it, your mixtape, and you put it on and you play it, what are you going to hear every time you play it? The same thing, unless you add more to it. Or you could erase it completely. What would that mean? It would mean you'd have a clean slate, a blank tape, a whole new virgin territory to start with all over again. So imagine if our magnetosphere is wiped out. Right?
Wow. Yeah. It sounds like there go the Akashic records, you might say. Like there Everything. Goes our
all the garbage gone. Maybe that's our fresh start. Maybe that's the virgin territory that the J-Rods talk about in the Doctrine of Convergent Timeline Paradox. They talk about exactly that. This whole new virgin timeline that nobody knows about. How could that be? How could there be a virgin timeline that no one knows anything about? The only way is if there's a blank slate and that everyone has to repopulate from scratch.
Yeah. And that's where one really has to have their heart centric, their own personal ionosphere, you know, magnetosphere, I should say, because definitely the individual who, now that's the thing of, you know, how people cultivate that. And I would say, well, there's many ways, but of course, we always know the old one, you know, meditation, which comes in many forms for people. Also making one's home an energy, you know, good vibes kind of place. We all know, well, maybe know about radionics and such like that. You can tune your home to have a nice natural Schumann resonance, and you can imprint your heart resonance into that also. So even things like walking barefoot and being attached to the earth, you know, that's a really important thing. And there's many people have never touched the earth. Well, some people have never seen a cow, but besides that, when you go and you walk, but they've eaten a lot of them. But if you walk on the grass, and I do believe that if you have a home with tile floor, if you've got, you know, a sidewalk cement, I think is very, very good. Really, we need to be, then we become physically a part of the magnetosphere. The Schumann resonance is going through us. And I think that's an incredibly important thing. So we all need to cultivate our own magnetosphere, because I do think that with the bifurcation of humanity, these two splitting timelines, which I sort of see as a lot of timelines on each side, everyone kind of has their own individual one to a certain extent, but we're all braided together, but there is this big split coming. Really, I do wonder if, as this happens, maybe it's what the solar flash is that people speak of, it does seem like a lot of humanity, if they don't get it this go round, it's almost like they are that clay that gets dropped on the potter's floor or just reworked, or they go back to the essential God consciousness and their individuation of spirit, of soul, just disappears or something. But it does seem that, I don't see it as punitive, but it's almost like after this happens, there'll be those that exist and then those that don't.
Well, they'll have been like that tape. They'll have been deleted.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, that's really great. You know? Yeah. And that's a great way to see manifestation too, because when you think about like the law of assumption and creating a state, you know, you're literally recording into the tape of consciousness. Here's this song. Here's this state that I want. This is what I want in reality. Then you simply, okay, now consciousness, God, play this. You know, it's quite the manifestational, you know, yes, visualization, but it's absolutely true.
This is exactly how it works, Craig. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have the splitting of timelines, and I think that many people do feel a future pull. I think that some people are feeling a pull towards the void, and then those who are feeling a pull towards the, well, really their own heart-centric magnetosphere and that of the cymatic pattern, and those that are in it with them, they're feeling that urgency. And I think that's where we might see a lot of people who are very unwell spiritually, physically, mentally, because they feel a future pull towards a dark void. And I think I'm seeing a lot of people in humanity right now who it's beginning to become very apparent more and more that it's almost like we have a part of the population is kind of a death worshiping cult, maybe because that's the future pull that they feel, just deletion.
Well, you know, the question is, how many of those thoughts that you harbor in your mind are your own?
Yes.
This is one of the big questions that, you know, do you know what free will is? We talk a lot about it's free will, right? We have free will. Do we really? Right. This is the question that is one of the fundamental questions people need to ask when they start awakening, because how much of your choices in your life have been truly made from a place of free will? If you're operating in a pre-programmed consciousness, you know, have you accepted the rules and regulations and customs of those around you, the world around you that, you know, raised you and made you from a baby into an adult? Carte blanche without questioning any of it? Because if you have, then you're only really running a program. You're not really exercising free will. And there's science to support that most people's decisions have already been made between 1/10 and 10 seconds before they actually carry out the physical action. That's how programmed people are. And you really need to question how committed you are to the program. And And of course, that you're going to have to go through the cognitive dissonance of mm-hmm. learning that, to let go of false beliefs, false rule sets, false ideologies that have been placed on you. And I don't mean, you know, transgenderism and 80 different, you know, genders and stuff. I'm not talking about that kind of a thing. I'm talking about, you know, the limited thought we have around what we can do, what we can manifest in the world as creator beings that are complete manifestors, and we're not even making use of it, right? And we've been told, you've got to do this, you got to go to school, you got to get the job, you got to make as much money as you can, right? Live your, you know, you only live to be this many years before you break down, your body will decay, you can only maximum average age of, you know, all these things are reinforced fictions. And the more we go into resonance with them, this is the timeline thing, and this is the idea that, yeah, everyone's got their own timeline, but we have this consensus timeline.
Yes.
The consensus timeline is the one we've all agreed on. It's that set of rules that the majority of us have sold ourselves short accepting. And so we're running on that timeline, and it's fake. You know, I mean, we've on the Inspired channel, what I talk with John Nolan about a lot is I talked about technologies that have been suppressed, which would have changed us and put us on a different timeline. I think the show is even called the alternative timeline or something like that. And that's because, you know, these technologies that I showed in that show go back over 100 years in some cases. And if they would have been allowed to take root and manifest in the physical world around us on a large scale, they would have brought us to a totally different frequency of a different timeline, different quality of living, but they weren't. And instead, what happened is the truth of those technologies and inventions was buried, and instead the fake, you know, materialistic control-centric forces that didn't want those things out there in the world for obvious vested interests pushed them away and pushed their limited perspective on society. And that is what people have accepted as being normal. So we're living in the past. Our timeline, the one that majority of people is living on, isn't even real. It's completely fictitious, all the way from what we learn in the school books to history to technology to science to healing, you know, all of it. It's just maybe music is the only thing that comes about as closest to reality than anything else, because music comes from another dimension, and it's not filtered. You know, it's like it comes. That's why you can have people that are extremely brilliant songwriters that might still be totally polluted as left-leaning extremists, like, you know, what's his name from Death Cab, you know, Cutie, what's that, Death Cab for Cutie, right?
Yeah.
It's like, love that music, but the guy's so left and so out of touch with some things. I can't believe that he would write that kind of music. It's evidence that the music comes from someplace else. It's unfiltered. Yeah. And it's, you know, and so that's why I think, you know, that's closer to the truth than, you know, what we have out there in the mainstream. And so that's part of really kind of breaking through those barriers. And so once you've gone through realizing that, and you begin to shred, you know, the falsities, you have cognitive dissonance. You have to realize you either adopt the truth, meaning you're going to be stepping away from a lot of the same, you've attracted people, your family, your structures in society that all believe the falsities, and you have to break away from them and live in your own world, right? Your own timeline in a way. And that's difficult for a lot of people. Right. So, you know, that's why they think the people that think that the timeline is just going to split, you know, it's going to be one that goes this way and one that goes that way. What, who's going to be on the one that goes that way? What, a couple of people that decided to go through the pain of cognitive dissonance and wake up. And then now the 10 of them or the 100,000 of them are living on the new world. It's like, it's just, for me, it's pointless. It's not going to be any good unless we make the transition collectively to this newer state of consciousness. Because it's no fun being alone. You know, I think a lot of people that are waking up, they go through this period of being sad because they're alone in their thoughts. They're alone in their ideologies. They have to find their tribe. They have to find the people that resonate with them, that are tied into the same frequencies. And that can be one of the most challenging things, period. Oh, right?
Yeah. Well, especially as people feel, I mean, there is a disorientation and a lack of balance, and you almost feel like gravity is coming from the side and not the bottom where it should be. I think it definitely can, you know, it can be disorienting, to put it lightly. But along with that, also people come and go. And that's a big one. I know many people who are really, I would say, I don't want to say suffering from that, but it's a process. You have to transmute it because a lot of people will turn away from you. And it could be family, friends, you name it. But, and it's nothing that you even did. They, it's just your, it's your energy. You could say it's your heart, magnetosphere, you know, as you change, a lot of people are going to go, that's too much for me. And they just disappear. And I find that to be very,
they just wrote me and said, we're done with you, man. That's gone too far.
Yeah,
I think you got.
Yeah.
I think you got like Nibiru coming in behind you or something there.
Let me actually fix that one. Yeah, here in Arizona, nothing stops the sun. So that's true. The turning away, and it almost feels like a little bit violent almost because they just go, enough of you, and they just disappear. And it leads many people to wonder, like, what did I do? And that's just one thing I would tell people. It's all you did was just you raised your heart magnetosphere, your energy field. You don't need to search for it, and it's nothing that you did. It's just going to be natural, and just take it as a compliment because it's going to happen, you know. But with that, that creates a vacuum, and that allows for people who are really consonant with your vibe, they're going to show up, you know. So it's always a vacuum that makes room for new people. Well, I've had you for quite a while. I don't want to, you know, keep you all day, but I do think that something that comes to mind was this morning with all of this, that a quote, just kind of downloaded from Jimi Hendrix, was you have to forget about what other people say, when you're supposed to die, or when you're supposed to be loving. You have to forget about all these things. You have to go and be crazy. Craziness is like heaven, you know? And I think that as disorienting as all this may be, people turning away, having to sharpen your intuition and discern what is real, all of this, this is the crazy heaven that I incarnated for. How about you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've always been the crazy type anyway. And I think it's like, it's been my nature since day one. And I think maybe that's given me a bit of an advantage because I've seen the resistance from the very beginning, and I found a way to travel alongside my fellow humans who are not necessarily into that same stuff, and, you know, subtly be there with them without being offended by them, without being, saddened by it excessively. I mean, it is saddening that most people are still on such a low level of frequency, but at the same time, it's just normal in a way. It's just the way it's always been. The path of those people who are waking up, even the tribes, the Indian tribes, the medicine man, you know, he was the crazy one, right? So, you know, we're just like, we're all like the medicine men of the new humanity. And we have to take the first step. And we know, like, you're right. You'll find other medicine men to hang with and to talk with and laugh with. And you've got to remember to have humor in all of this, because if you don't have a good sense of humor, you're going to suffer a lot more than you have to. Because a large part of it is just when you recognize how lost many people are and how off track our timeline has gotten, it's very easy to get sunk into a hole that can be pretty depressing. So remember that you're not necessarily a human being who's a spirit, but that you're a spirit who's a human being. So, you know, that's another thing. That's one of the foundational thoughts of spirituality, is that we're just having a human experience. And I think Jesus talks about it as well, you know, just like, be not of the earth, right? So it means that it doesn't mean that you are aloof. It just means that it's a protective mechanism, that you're in the earth, but you're not of the earth. So
be in this world, but not of it. And that was something Stuart Wilde talked about, a great, great mystical character, Stuart Wilde. And he said that he termed it fringe dwellers. And he was like, you're on the edge. So you really are the medicine men, the medicine women, and you're on the edge of the village. You've always been to the side. And us fringe dwellers that have always been in the world, but not of it necessarily, we have, I think, a really important role to play. Like what we're doing here is we're used to it. Like I was born weird, right? So I mean, I've been doing this forever. It's just, this is like normal, right? I mean, it's fine, you know? But the thing is, we're used to it. We've been doing it for years, decades, you know, we're used to it, where many people are getting a crash course in all of this. The light's hitting them and they're becoming light activists. And they're like, where'd my reality go? What's going on? So I think that we have an important role to play, and definitely not coming from an egotistical standpoint here, but it's really important to be that crazy person. You say, you know what, everybody already knows that I'm crazy, so here's the deal, you know, you can come to me with all your crazy stuff. And people do, if you're that, I don't like to use that term, but safe place, but if you're that place where a person can say, you know, I have to admit, like, my entire life is falling apart and I don't know who I am and everything pisses me off and reality just sucks, you can say, oh dude, that's level three. I mean, okay, here, read Rudolf Steiner, do this, do that. You know, here you go. And I think it's really important, because I think a lot of people are getting a crash course. It's happening to them very quickly as this accelerates. And those of us that are used to it, I think it's important to play that role. Be the crazy person that people can go to when they start feeling crazy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Frank Jacob. And you can go to frankjacob.com and you can find all of Frank Jacob's stuff. Definitely the documentaries are amazing. I know I'll be watching A Tale of Two Timelines soon. Is there anything I missed that you might like to finish up with?
Oh, you might want to mention that I'm going to be live in person in Sedona on the 22nd of April at the Sedona Cosmic Awakening Conference, which is Devera Thunderbeats hosting that. So I'm going to be speaking on the afternoon of Saturday, the 22nd of April. So if you wanted to come and see me in person or hang out or whatever, and you're near Arizona, in Sedona, Arizona, then that's one place that I'll be making an appearance. It'd be great to see people in the flesh as opposed to just, you know, virtually all the time. And other than that, I'm working on this new webinar. I'll be making announcements pretty soon. And right now it looks like I'm not going to make it before I have to leave for the States. So it'll probably be coming out sometime in May, I would imagine, before I'm able to finish it. So, that's my next thing that I'm working on. And Tanya and I are working on stuff all the time. And we're working on a film, like I mentioned to you earlier, that'll probably be coming out hopefully summer, fall. And we'll be making announcements on that. So I can maybe reach out to you then and just give you a couple of tips or something.
Oh, that'd be absolutely wonderful. Yeah. And we're just an hour south of Sedona. So that's a common place for us to go. So we will probably see you up there. And Sedona's a magical place. Great, great energy there. And definitely full of fringe dwelling crazy people. So if you show up, everybody, you'll be right at home. All right. Well, take care. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be here.